This is The Guardian.
Hi, Noor Haider here, coming to you from Gadigal land. This year, Guardian Australia won a Walkley Award for a digital series called The Descendants. Today we're bringing you the first episode of a special two-part series with the reporters behind that investigation. Indigenous Affairs reporter Sarah Collard and Lorena Allam from UTS's Jimbana Institute speak about the discovery of a diary, sometimes written in code, detailing mass killings in Australia. They also meet Australians who are confronting the truth of their family's involvement in colonial violence. And just a warning before we start, this episode contains historical records that use racist and offensive language and descriptions of events that will be distressing to some listeners. We'll link to some services at the end of the episode. Okay, here's host Lorena Allam.
April 4. Started after breakfast. We pushed in search of the...
It's 1852. A man named Major Logue writes in his diary.
Tied up our horses in a thicket and crawled on our hands and knees.
Much of it is the banal goings-on of a country property, except for the parts written in code.
Within 260 yards when the natives saw us. Fired both barrels of my gun and wounded one fellow in the rump. Thomason and Dickie shot one dead.
Earlier, he'd written that the cattle had been stolen and that...
Shot three of them for it.
Covered up by a code, Logue's diary contains a story of murder and massacre, of shame and fear. The truth can be messy. It can leave us with more questions than answers. It relies on people's memory, on recordings and writings from long ago, on a commitment to be honest, despite the fear and shame. Truth-telling is essential to this country moving forward. But what does that really mean? Families across Australia are coming to terms in very different ways with the real-life challenges of truth-telling about our violent past. For them, this work is very real, very personal, and very local. There are no guidelines. Uncovering the truth comes with the risk of family estrangement. It can lead to denial and indifference. There can also be a liberation. In this series, you will meet ordinary Australians who are challenging what they call colonial silence. This is The Descendants, a two-part full story about Australia's reckoning with the truth of its colonial past. And I'm Lorena Allam. This is Episode 1, Bootnell Springs. I'm joined by my colleague, Sarah Collard. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Maybe you should describe for everybody how we came to be in West Australia and how did you hear about the story?
So it came about when we'd come across some local stories that families had done on Bootnell Springs massacre and how communities there had come together for a 170th anniversary. And through talking to people there, we began to speak with descendants of victims and survivors and perpetrators on both sides. And the more we talked to people, the more they said that we should talk to so-and-so and we should talk to that person and this person. And it just kept on expanding and expanding.
We were in Geraldton, that's Yamatji country. Just describe it a bit for us.
So that's a coastal city, around 4.5 hours drive from the capital city, Perth, or if you're flying about an hour's flight, you arrive in this bumpy kind of short tarmac on the runway, and it's country which is really beautiful. It's a coastal city, so you're, you know, driving along coastal scenes and there's a lot of bush and scrub and the yellow earth there, and it's really beautiful country, particularly in, you know, you get a bit further out in Geraldton and, you know, these places around Gwynedd and Bootnell Springs where it's these rolling hills and lakes and gorges, and it's filled with corellas and birds and sheoaks everywhere, and they kind of tell the story of this place.
So who was Major Logue?
So Logue was a very eminent and respected pastoralist and the first MP of Geraldton at that time in the mid-1870s from 1874. But before he was this respected landowner, he when he first arrived in the Gwynedd region and was exploring Champion Bay and taking up that land, he was involved in multiple killings of Aboriginal people. Publicly, there hasn't been any records of him being involved in any killings, but what we've been able to find is his diaries by his own account, which are written in code.
Mm-hmm. Now, his diaries, how did you come across these, Sarah?
So it was while researching the Bootinel Springs massacres, and we'd been speaking to a lot of descendants around their settler descendants, and they're all the same names that kept on coming up. There were all of these five or six settler families, and one of them was Logue. And while speaking with a historian there, I had learned that Batty Library had made a copy in the 1950s and that they had scanned all of the diaries in full.
I remember when you told me there are these colonial diaries written in code, and I went, what? I mean, it was so unusual that it was like we couldn't really wait to get to the library to see what this was all about.
I didn't really believe it. Like, I didn't think that it would be so obviously written in code. The handwriting is very loopy and chaotic and incredibly messy. You can barely make a word out. But out of it leaps these code, which is this kind of square, angular boxes and half arrows with dots on some of the words and letters. And it's the kind of thing that makes the hairs on the back of your neck stick up when you see that. You know, you're scrolling through the microfilm and then this jumps out of the page at you, and it's
disturbing, hey?
Yeah.
But we knew that Nan Broad, the historian based in Geraldton, knew what this code said and knew that she had some understanding of it. So we were desperate to get to Geraldton to ask her what it was all about.
I knew it was very, very unique to have 50 years straight of a diary. I don't know whether anyone else is aware there would be one. And, of course, it would detail the building of a property from absolutely nothing into a very prosperous farm.
So when we spoke to her, she said to us, it's called Pigpen. It's a form of Masonic code.
He puts that comment, and it's a sentence usually, in a code, a very, very simple, basic code, which he shifted. He altered it very, very slightly, but it's pathetically simple.
So after we spoke to Nan, we got in the car, right, and we were frantically Googling Pigpen.
We found all of these online decipherers to kind of work it out, and we're punching in the code and we've got it up on our phones and trying to work it out, and it's all nonsensical.
Yeah.
And then we're sitting there with a pen and paper. When you're decoding the words, it's quite a process, kind of. You've got this grid up and you're kind of like stroking out each letter, and then
it was S. H-O-T, 2-W-O. It's like this slow-moving atrocity coming out at you.
K-I-L-L-E-D.
And it was sickening, actually.
As the words form, it's quite confronting seeing them pop up where he's actually talking about killing people, and in quite graphic but uncaring language. It was like nothing to
him. He was more upset about his horse falling in a hole at one point than the very matter of fact way he talks about dispatching people. You know, applied a pill, I think he called it. The irony is he did it to hide something, but it's actually easier to read than his handwriting.
Exactly, yes, much easier. It's glaring.
So what do we know about it was the early 1850s, wasn't it, when the European settlers came up from Perth with sheep and cattle?
Yes, a lot of settlers had been moving further and further along the coast, and they had taken their sheep and cattle and crops and their families as well, and they'd been exploring, in their terms, these very fertile, beautiful lands from Nagaja people and other Aboriginal people in that district. And as they took up thousands and thousands of hectares, there was increasing encroachment as they went amongst Aboriginal people's land and borders. And as you can imagine, there was a conflict when that happened.
So for the Europeans, it was, you know, a sheep would go missing or there'd be a conflict over water sources, say. And that made things worse. The tensions sort of increased.
Yes, and there was a lot of anger and frustration on their behalf of Aboriginal people maybe spearing or killing their sheep or cattle because, of course, as the closer and closer they went, they, you know, stole their watering holes, they killed all the kangaroos and their traditional food sources, and Aboriginal people were hungry and sheep are easy to kill.
Mm.
Then Aboriginal people began to go missing as well as gangs of these settlers and farmers would go out seeking Aboriginal people to kill in response to the taking of livestock.
So there was this botanist who'd worked with the local Yamaji people, John Nicol Drummond. He learnt Yamaji language, right? Or he could speak Aboriginal languages when he got there. And he was instrumental in what happened next in the winter of 1854. Can you talk us through what happened next?
Yes. So John Nicol Drummond was a native police inspector, self-appointed, and he had travelled from Perth where he grew up. He had apparently mixed with a lot of Aboriginal people in that district, learning Noongar and other local languages. So he knew a lot about Aboriginal people's activities and how they hunted, where they would camp with their families. And so he eventually brought together a whole suite of farmers and station hands and workers to go out and teach the Aboriginal people a lesson because of these repeated stock thefts and things like that. So it was early morning when he rode over on his horse with several ranch hands and other stockmen and workers, and they were all heavily armed with guns, and we're told from the old histories that they arrived in a kind of a formation over the hill, and because the sun was coming up, the people who were camping on the banks were blinded, and they just saw these terrifying images of these people on horseback shooting. And oral histories say that 300 people, men, women and children, were murdered on those riverbanks, and the river ran red with blood. The official records state that just 30 people died, but Yamaji people believe that that is much higher, of course. And what's interesting about John Nicol Drummond is for a lot of people, they believe that he was almost like a spy, that he was using that information that he had gathered from Noongar and other local peoples against the Nagajar and Yamaji peoples in that kind of brutal period where he was killing people.
And this is where this brings us to Major Logue's diaries, because Major Logue was John Nicol Drummond's brother-in-law. We know about Logue that in 1850 he took up about 400 hectares of land along the Grenfell River. So we knew that Nan Broad, the historian based in Geraldton, she was going to provide a lot of answers that we needed.
Yes, so she had spent the past 6 years decoding these diaries and editing Logue's diaries for publication. When we speak to her, she tells us quite matter-of-factly that Logue, it was quite clear to her that he was killing people.
Oh, yeah, he said we took them out, I think were his expressions. I mean, it was all just run-of-the-mill. That's what we did. We went and dug holes for the fence there, and then we went over and we took those fellows out, and then we went back and milked the cow or whatever we did. And it was just part of the day.
When she first saw those diaries 30 years ago, the person who had those diaries had given her access to start that whole process.
So Nan Broad knew the Logue family because she'd grown up in one of the big pioneer families herself.
And, you know, everyone knows everyone.
She also said she's certain that he was involved in the Bootinall massacre.
And Logue would have been part of Bootinall. He would have been right in the front there. You know, he was only just up the river, for goodness sake. He and probably his men.
She's quite certain that Logue was involved with this because he was married into the family. He would have been one of those who other settlers and other people would have come to as well, as those diaries allude to.
Everyone knows they did it. I mean, everyone knows up here that Logue shot them.
So Logue doesn't mention that incident in his diary, but when we did look at it, the entries for the winter of 1854, which is when the massacre took place, they're pretty dense and messy and chaotic, and there's writing in the margins, and it's really untidy compared to the rest of his diary.
It seems like the work of a very desperate man who's under pressure, very tense and chaotic.
So the book that Nan Broad has been working on all these years is almost ready for publication, but she says she and the owner of the diaries have decided to leave out those coded sections.
She believes that Logue is being singled out for attention because in her words and in the words of many other settlers around there, that all of the families there did killings.
So when she said she's still publishing the diaries without the coded sections that detail the killings, we asked her why.
Well, I suppose we are trying to hide something. We're trying to hide the written word from future repercussions. And when you think deeply, there could be nothing to do with you lot, of course, but you'll just be an accessory to, not an accessory even. I mean, you'll just be the catalyst that perhaps it came out, and we don't want future problems. And we just don't want it in writing. You can talk, fine, that's fine.
Perth-based publisher Hesperian Press, which has published dozens of colonial accounts, is working with Broad to edit and release the diaries. Asked if removing the coded sections would mean the edited diaries were no longer accurate accounts, owner Peter Bridge said, "Our edition makes no attempt to deceive, suppress or editorialise. Rather, we have published a primary document faithfully and unflinchingly, as is our usual method." He said the coded sentences were in unique characters and added, "They are not omitted, they are simply unprintable." He said the location of the omitted sections will be clearly indicated in the forthcoming book. He also said, "If your concern is that the code may conceal politically potent material, I suggest that you take that up with Logue himself, who is unfortunately unavailable for an interview." He said, "We publish the diaries because they're historical documents, not a moral confession."
So while the colonial silence is still quite strong, Major Logue does have direct descendants who do want to talk about truth-telling and who do want this story to be told.
Yeah, we went out to Perenjori, about 3.5 hours drive from Geraldton, and we met with Major Logue's great-grandson, Phil, and his son, Moss.
Yeah, there's a site.
When we spoke to Phil and Moss, they were incredibly open about wanting this truth to come out finally after so many years of silence.
I heard some stories, probably it was only 10 or 15 years ago when it was, and then it was really only the nitty-gritty in the last couple of years. Yeah, so it's pretty recent.
Having a yarn with Phil, he's very casual and straight shooter, very funny, and he's not seen the diaries in person, but he doesn't doubt his family's history.
He was really ready to talk, wasn't he, about that whole history of his family.
It was quite shocking because when we'd spoken to other people there, there was a bit of a reticence to really engage with this and a bit of a tiptoeing around even the use of the word massacres. It was something that a lot of families didn't really want us to use that word. They were still very much like, oh, it's a battle. But Phil was completely different. He was really open about his family's history and wanted this all to come out.
Dad died 20 years ago, so he's never told me. So stuff died in 1880, the knowledge. You know, we don't sing the stories down the line. If it's not written, we don't see it. And if it's written, it disappears in 20 years with silverfish and cleansed. So you cleanse the story and you tell the good bits.
He and his son had really started reckoning with this only in the past few years that really uncovered the full story.
So when you mentioned Bootnell Springs, I was immediately transported back there and listening to those she-oaks sort of whispering in the wind. And it's pretty windy around Geraldton, so, you know, you think the ancestors have got a lot to say.
Yes, and the winds are so fierce that when you're driving along the highways there, you can see these trees and they're just almost flat and parallel to the fields. Even the trees bow to those winds. And when you're looking out in the water, you can see pelicans gliding over the water and the sun's going down as we head out When we were there, we spoke to Derek and the owner councillor, and they are Nagaja Yamaji people from the Geraldton area, and they've grown up there and their families have grown up there for thousands of generations.
The records can say what they want. Mm. This is our story and we will tell it, you know. The blood called out to us, so we're telling this story, we're writing these songs, we're singing our songs again.
The owner is a playwright and a songwriter, and Derek is a elder and a tour guide, and he works with people in the area looking at truth-telling and descendants and families coming together in the history of the region.
I tell a lot of the tourists when I bring them out, send the shade of these trees here that I can picture the old people watching me, and I get like a goosebumps feeling, and it's like, yeah, you remember our story and always pass it on.
And Derek says that as the sun goes down, the wails of the children can be heard, followed by the cries of women and finally the men.
Some of the people that live out here reckon it's quite spooky because they'll see a big fire burning and then they'll come down to have a look what's going on. Then they'll get here and there's no fire. Then they'll go back to their block and then they'll hear people singing and dancing and then they'll come and check it out again and there's nobody there.
These are heard not only by Yamaji people but also the surrounding farmers and descendants of the settlers to the area.
So, Sarah, what did they hear about Bootnell Springs growing up, Derek and Fiona?
So they've heard this story of Bootnell Springs and the massacres since they were just little kids from their grandfather and father. And since they were really young, they've been told that Bootnell Springs was a bad place. They were warned not to really ask too much about it, not to hang around. And as they grew a bit older, they gradually learn more and more from their elders about what had taken place there.
This place has been like a real taboo place for us to come. So for years we didn't really come here for a long time, but then as we started to come back, we acknowledged the story that this place holds because it's also a Dreamtime story as well for us. And we tell it like I'm telling now. We don't tell it with a heavy heart or with anger. We always remember our past. We tell our stories, but we're not dwelling on it like... We're not about that. We're about recognising it.
Bootnell was used to be a traditional camping site, you know, for Yamaji Nangaja mob. There's a lot of traditional foods there. There's, you know, Derek was showing us the fish.
Nangaja people, we show our respect to the Bimba and to the spirit of the water because we like to get our sand and throw it in the water first. So.
And we all walked down to the site under the she-oaks near the river there, and it was late afternoon. The kids were running around. You could see them flitting through the trees. And then Derek started telling the story.
In the morning, all the warriors and all the men had gone hunting. They'd already left the place. The women and children and the old people were left here. Some young men were left here as well to look after them. And all the people that were here that day were massacred and killed in this spot here.
What?
So after Derek told that story, Amanda Rowland was there. She's the descendant of the botanist John Nicol Drummond, who led the massacre. She'd come down from her home about 200 k's up the coast, and she'd come with other settler descendants. It wasn't their first meeting with Fiona and Derek either, was it?
No, these are conversations and meetings that they've been having for the last couple of years, and one of the most powerful was the one just last year on the 170th anniversary of the Bootnell massacre, and they came to the site to hear more about what their ancestors had done. And it's something that Amanda had always wondered growing up as well. She'd thought that her ancestor was this great guy and they were from this powerful descendant family, and you know, they've got coves and streets and names all named after them.
So I grew up feeling I was very, very special. Mm-hmm. And then a bit of information started to filter through as a teenager when I realised it wasn't all fabulous, brave pioneer stuff. But, you know, there was a war. My family did really well out of it.
So for her to hear this story, it was something was really quite confronting.
I dropped six generations of shit. Basically, the land, the people, something spoke through me, and I think I lost that really confused shame, you know, that really confused stuff, which is more than shame. I don't know what it is.
So for Amanda, connecting with the counsellors and working with Fiona to really reconcile with her family's history and her legacy was something that she really wanted to do, and that was something that's really been part of her motivations as someone who's benefited from colonial violence for generations.
And here was an Aboriginal person, the Ngagatja people, inviting me to really look at this. It was just really profound for me.
Amanda Drummond remained shaken and scared by what she had learnt and is still learning even as this project unfolded.
Oh, it's just, you know, you think you've heard it and then whoosh, you hear something else. And then, I don't know, when Derek was speaking, the Sea Oak stopped talking. I don't know, I really noticed that. I think the wind stopped. Now it's, I've always found these groves of she oaks to be quite, I don't know, spooky, because the wind makes that noise.
It was a very powerful afternoon, as I remember. It was a pretty powerful thing bringing together the descendants of the perpetrators and the descendants of the survivors to that place where it happened.
And many of those people had never met before. The owner had brought her sisters and grandchildren and kids, and they'd come together with the settler side of things. And it was a moment where they all kind of clocked each other, really. And some of the descendants there, they learned things that they had never heard before, and they were quite shaken by that. And that was something that was really confronting for a lot of those white people who'd heard these things for the first time.
At Bootinall that afternoon, Fiona had her grandchildren with her and they were playing around, but they were listening. You could tell they were listening very carefully to what was being told, you know, the way kids do. They're listening without showing you that they are taking it all in. I mean, everywhere in Australia where people were massacred, there is unfinished business. The land holds this truth of colonisation, just like it holds all the stories of beauty and creation and what Fiona calls the genius of Aboriginal people. She believes it's important to tell them all the stories, sing them all side by side. But it's time for non-Indigenous people to listen too.
They say it happened so long ago, get over it. Yes, okay, let's get over it. Just tell it right, tell it truthfully first. Can't get over something if you don't even know what happened.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, something that really struck me throughout all this was how generous and kind and warm the councillors were through all of this, even meeting people on that land, that beautiful place where they had lost their ancestors. And just with that level of grace is something that is extraordinary.
And it's like, well, okay, maybe they're losing their comfortable untruth, you know? They've got to move out of that comfort zone where it feels good and safe, but it's actually not the truth. So just release themselves. I think they need to release themselves. They need to actively seek it, release it, release themselves. We can't do it for them. They have to do it.
That was Ngagatja Yamatji woman Fiona Councillor. And before her, we heard from Guardian Australia's Indigenous Affairs reporter Sarah Collard. This is part one of a two-part special full story. In part two of The Descendants, Guardian Australia's Ella Archibald Binge travels to central Queensland in search of the truth behind massacres there and the possible connection to one of Australia's great AFL pioneers. If this episode has raised any issues for you, you can contact Lifeline on 131114. And Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners, UMOP can call 13YARN, 139276. To see pictures and read articles from the Descendants Project, you can go to theguardian.com. This episode was produced by Camilla Hannan and Karishma Luthria. Camilla did the sound design and mix. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. And I'm Lorena Allam.